I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, and welcome to Series 3 of the Legacy Tapes, a series of podcasts exploring how to leave something lasting in the ephemeral medium of theatre. I'm Rebecca Atkinson-Lord, and today I'm talking with the incredible Lynn Gardner. Lynn has had an eminent career as a theatre critic, journalist and author. She's worked for The Independent, The Guardian, The Stage, amongst lots of others, and is undoubtedly one of British theatre's leading advocates. Hello, Lynn.
Hello.
Hello. So you're the first person that I'm talking to that doesn't identify primarily as a theatre maker. And you're so beloved amongst the theatre-making community that you kind of an honorary one of us. I feel like you shape the ecology as much as most of the artists I know. So it seemed like a good place to start with you as my first non-theatre maker guest. You've got such an incredibly powerful voice, and I feel like that's helped launch quite a lot of iconic companies that I think of as iconic now. Have you been conscious of using that impact to shape the theatre ecology in a way that will leave a legacy for future theatre folk?
Well, I guess it would be really disingenuous to try and pretend that you're not aware that you can influence in some way. Mm-hmm. And I think it is one of the things that critics do all the time. I think the thing that happened to me, which was two things, which is, first of all, I think really quite early in my career, and certainly after I went to The Guardian, mm-hmm. Where I realised that there was a lot of theatre that I thought was really, really interesting and that simply was not being covered. And I think there mm-hmm. is absolutely always that question that what is reviewed is often what is kind of valued in the culture. Secondly, that I was very aware that often when I read other critics, my feeling was that what they were doing was shaping the culture in a way by holding it back, by being gatekeepers a lot mm-hmm. of the time. And I was incredibly aware of that when I was in my early 20s in the 1980s, and I think there was then a sort of first wave of women writing mm-hmm. about theatre, and often the reviews would say, oh, this, you know, young woman is a sparky young thing, but she doesn't understand structure and she should go away and read the plays of J.G.
She's not a man.
Yes, well, maybe that's exactly what they were saying. So I think that actually I sort of felt that my job was to be a midwife, not to be a gatekeeper in some way. And then I think the other thing that became really apparent to me, I suppose, after a period of time, was that I was as much interested in process as I was in product. And I guess that during my 23 years at The Guardian, the fact that about 2008, I was regularly writing a blog, a blog that allowed me to sort of think out loud about theatre and about the industry and about how theatre is made and all those things, suddenly made my job a great deal more interesting than simply going to the theatre every night.
Yeah, and giving a quick verdict.
And giving a quick verdict with a star rating at the top of it. Yeah?
Yeah.
And actually, if I'm perfectly honest, I think that, I don't know, sometimes I think about this and I, of course, you can't say for sure, but I do wonder whether I would have carried on reviewing theatre in the way that I did if it had not been for the fact that the blog also allowed me to think out loud about theatre and how it worked.
Yes.
And that the two went hand in hand. And often, I think quite interestingly, that some of the blogs that I enjoyed writing most were those which quite clearly referenced a lot of work, but tried to put them into some kind, that work into some kind of context.
Yeah. And a conversation with each other.
Yeah.
Which is, I think that was one of the things when I was a younger theatre maker, was just having this sense of there being a dialogue between works of art that I'd never really been aware of. As you know, as a kid in Wolverhampton, you don't know that this might be responding to.
And I think that's endlessly fascinating. It's one of the reasons I really love Edinburgh is because of the fact that when you're in Edinburgh, one, it's a culture of work that's often been made quite quickly and quite quickly in the moment just before it is shown, which can have real downsides, but can also mean that it often is kind of quite reflective of the world and the changes that are going on. So I think that's good. But I think there's also something about the fact that if you are seeing five or six things a day, inevitably things start kind of moving about in your head like snooker balls, you know, smashing into each other. Yeah. And that's really, really fascinating. Yeah.
Are there things that you are conscious of wanting to see change? Like, do you, I mean, I know there are because I've read your writing for a long time, but what is it that you want to change the world into? What would you like to be midwifing?
To a large degree, it's funny, I remember once having a conversation with one of my peers, somebody who's a bit younger than me, and he sort of said, I want to change theatre. And I was quite interested in that because, to some degree, I don't see it really as my job to be there changing theatre. I think it's the job of artists to do that. And on the whole, I think they do a jolly good job about it.
But you're very good at going, hey, guys, look at this thing. Or look at this thing in the structure. Or the process.
Well,
or
maybe I do, but I think all I'm doing is noticing things which are already there and perhaps nudging certain things and being less interested by other things.
Yeah.
So I think it's my job to keep my eyes and my ears and my heart kind of open. And just try and spot what it is that artists are interested in, and try and write about that.
That's a good way to put it, actually, because I feel like one of the things that I think I probably thought early in my career was that what I was interested in didn't really matter. It was what other people wanted to see.
But I think that's a great mistake for a lot of young theatre makers, isn't
absolutely.
It?
Absolutely.
Because what it is being driven by the market.
Yeah.
It's like sitting down to write a novel and saying, what is the novel I want to write? But rather than doing that, saying,
what will they buy?
What is it that people will buy?
Yeah.
And I think that way, well, not only is it a cul-de-sac in terms of theatre culture, but actually I think you're doomed to be wrong.
Yeah,
I remember once having a conversation with Nika Burns, the producer, West End producer of NIMAX Theatres, and I remember her saying to me, the only time she had ever, this is a few years ago, the only time she'd really ever lost her shirt was when she went, I hate this and I don't see the value of it, but I think it will sell.
Do you know what? I would agree with that.
Yeah.
I reckon the only times I've ever really, as a curator, the only times I've ever really ballsed up is when it was something that I didn't care about.
Yeah. But I think those things are really interesting, aren't they? Because I think one of the things that I find quite interesting for me as somebody who is writing about theatre, as a critic, and I guess also for somebody like you as a curator, about those questions of taste and about how your taste shapes what it is that you support or champion in some ways, but also about that ability to sometimes look at something and go, this is completely not to my taste, but I can really see the value of it.
Because there are lots of things like that. Like, I see a lot of work. I'm like, I find the point at which I'm calculating the weekly running costs of the show, then I know that it is not my take. Then yeah. I'm not going to find something to redeem this. But quite often there are things that are so far beyond anything I would ever make. You know, probably anything by David Hare I would never direct.
Yeah.
But I can see how other people find them so deeply valuable and resonant, and they can be beautifully done. You know, I feel like this is the second time I've picked on David Hare in this podcast. He doesn't listen, I'm sure. But if you do, David, sorry. So you talked about things you like and things you don't, you know, just your taste.
Well, I think there's something else around taste there, though, yeah. that I kind of find quite interesting, because, again, I think that people often want to kind of second guess what your taste is. Mm-hmm. And often I think that they're completely wrong. And one of the things that I think is so valuable, and I think it was to do with my upbringing and my mum. My mum was a really keen theatre goer.
Mm.
But she might have been considered what some people would say was an entirely indiscriminate theatre goer. And I lived near Croydon, and the Fairfield Halls was nearby. And the Fairfield Halls in those days, it was not a producing theatre, but it operated in a sense like a rep theatre, which is that it had a different show that passed through every single week. And we didn't go every week, but we went quite regularly. And so we'd go and see an Agatha Christie thriller, and then we'd go and see a Chekhov play. In a way, I just loved it that I didn't really realise it at the time, but what my mum was kind of giving me was a sort of an education in theatre.
That eclectic ground.
And I think it's still true now that I really like all kinds of different theatre. And I think there's something that sometimes slightly goes on, which is that, and I think it's happens both amongst audiences and I think by makers sometimes as well, which is that they, you know, they love the area of work in which they operate, or which they've decided that they are the audience for that kind of work, whether it's immersive work or new writing or dance or whatever it might be. But they're quite closed off to other forms, and in some cases, I think quite sneery around them. Yeah. You know, I've definitely heard people say to me, "Oh, you actually like musicals?"
Yeah.
But I mean, I do. I mean, it's rare that you see a really good.
Yeah.
You know, a great musical, because I think the form is so hard to get right.
And it's so easy to cheat, because you've got all of that emotional manipulation with the music. So I think it's easy to be to let something slide when the musical do it for you. I find a similar thing in that I get people send me, in terms of what people ask me to do jobs, ask me to do work, whatever, they send me things that are incredibly serious and have a social conscience. And you know, I didn't see a piece of theatre that wasn't the pantomime until I was a teenager.
Yeah.
So that's my grounding. You know, I really want custard pies and wagon wheels. I want silliness.
Yeah.
I don't think silliness is an excuse for something not being thoughtful. I think it has to be thoughtful as well. But I was, you know, I'm like, please, could someone just send me a piece of, like, fluff? And I'm fascinated that even just me as a curator and maker, that happens, that kind of what is allowed to be available to me is quite narrow. So for you, that must be even more frustrating, I guess, when people just assume what you're gonna.
I mean, of course, the way that you can try and bypass that is simply to try and make sure that you really do see a very wide range of shows. But yes, I mean, what I often feel like is like the kid with my nose pushed up against the sweet shop window, going, "Oh, I'd like a bit of this, and I'd like a bit of that."
And you see, whenever I see you in Edinburgh, you're always like, we always see each other passing on the street between shows. It was nice to see you, but I'm 4 minutes late for this thing. And I think you see more work than anybody else that I know. Anybody else sort of writing about this sort of theatre. which is incredibly generous of you. Do you...
Well, it is. But on the other hand, you know, sometimes when I've turned up at a regional theatre, people kind of say, oh, thank you so much for coming. And I think that's a reflection of the fact that often regional theatre has not had kind of coverage, particularly by the mainstream. But actually, my answer to that, without wanting to be rude in the set, is to say, actually, this is my job. Yeah, I'm supposed to be here, and I really don't think that you can do the job unless you are really prepared to go out there and see a wide range of shows. Mm-hmm. And about at Edinburgh always feels to me like my larder. Yes, it feels like you go to Edinburgh, you stock up the larder, mm-hmm. you see lots of shows. The other thing that's really great about Edinburgh is that the companies I go and see absolutely know that I won't necessarily be able to write about everything that I see. It would be impossible on seeing 5 or 6 shows a week, but are generous enough to feel that it's worthwhile giving me the ticket. And the point really is about it is that, there's been huge numbers of companies who my very first glimpse of them has been in Edinburgh, perhaps as a graduate company or, you know, a couple of years later. Actually, I may not have written about them at that point, but I've kind of filed it away in my head, and I will go make a point of going back to see them. Yeah.
Do you feel away, because you have... You have such power, especially in Edinburgh. I am aware that there are shows that I have worked on that you have sold out for us. Not deliberately, that wasn't your plan, but are you aware of that weight of responsibility, and especially in Edinburgh when the financial models are so agonising for all the artists? What's that?
Well, you can't but be aware of it.
Mm.
And at the same time, obviously, to some degree, you have to push it away. Because, I mean, Edinburgh is probably slightly different in that, in fact, because of the fact that space is limited and the number of shows that you can write about is limited, I would often prefer to accentuate the positive rather than write negatively. What is the point of writing a review of a very young company and writing, you know, a mean negative review.
Don't make it worse.
There is really no point in doing that. I mean, I would have no qualms about doing that for certain kinds of projects, and particularly if it feels...
Yeah, for the grown-ups who've got a couple of million quid behind them.
Yeah, and who are packing an audience in and will sell out really whatever I say. But of course you have to be aware that there is a responsibility. And, and at my worst, I spend my life kind of looking through old copies of Theatre Record and going, oh, Godling, you didn't say that. How could you? How truly dreadful. But I think that thing of, you know, I think one of the things is that you can't but do my job and actually, in a way, be having a kind of constant dialogue going on in your head.
Because you just have to encounter it as an audience member.
A very educated
audience member.
Yeah, I mean, and that's really, fundamentally, the only difference between me and most other people is sheer amount of stuff that I actually see. And the fact that I get the free tickets in order to do it, because otherwise it would be completely impossible. But otherwise, I don't see what I'm doing. And again, really, I'm not kind of trying to, sort of be dishonest about it.
Mm.
But I don't see what I'm doing as being some kind of pronouncement. Other people, I am aware, might see it like that. I see what I'm doing as being a response to what it is that I see. And in the end, actually, I don't think I've ever managed to write a word if I thought about it in terms of being tablets of stone, rather than going, this was Lynn Gardner, keen theatre-goer, going to the theatre, and...
She thought this on this rainy Thursday.
Yeah, and of course, actually, what you might think on the following sunshiny Totally. Wednesday might be different. Mm. I mean, I am a great believer that we take all our baggage into the theatre with us. And that's why some shows speak to us and some shows don't. Of course, there are also those absolutely glorious shows where you take all your baggage into the theatre. The fact that you're frozen cold, that you waited for the bus, that, you know, the cat puked before you left the house. And actually, you forget all those things.
Yeah. One of my greatest regrets is I think I was about 25, Ian McKellen's last King Lear, not this one, I had a precious ticket that I could afford for like 15 quid or something. And I'd just been on holiday and my plane was delayed, so I ended up not having slept for a couple of days, and I went. I was like, I'm bloody going, I'm not going to miss it. And I just couldn't take it in. I couldn't be loving to the performers. And was really bloody grumpy about it afterwards. And now I can't afford the damn ticket, so I can't go and see if it was better or not. I'm really conscious of how that, what you carry in, makes a huge difference.
Yeah. I love that idea of being loving towards the performers. And I think that's really true, because, you know, I just think that in 99.9% of cases, you know, performers are so loving towards the audience and that they really give us something. And it sometimes does quite annoy me about actually the way that people seem to dismiss acting as being easy. And it's not.
It's, I mean, it's the training. Good actors train like athletes.
Yeah.
It's a phenomenal... Yeah. Phenomenal discipline. I think the loving thing that's a director's thing, because I think you spend so long looking at them, you do fall in love with them a little bit, apart from when they do that one thing you've asked them to do seven times differently, you know.
Yeah.
So I think maybe that sense of love, it feels like, you know, when kids do their thing, they put on their play, or I used to tap dance on a tin tray to the soundtrack to The Snowman.
Right.
So my parents...
I'd like to have seen that.
Oh, my God. That's why I'm in theatre, because my parents were like, anything to shut her up. Yeah. Just get rid of her. Yeah. And you have to look with love to see the joy, I think.
Yeah.
I think that's how we should look much more.
Yeah.
Ages ago, we talked a little bit about taste. And I sort of just thinking about the 28 years you said since you've been doing this.
Oh, more than that. Yes.
28 years at The Guardian. God.
No, well, I was 23 years at The Guardian, and then about 3 years before that, I had been there for a short time.
So in the lifetime that you've been doing this, I guess what counts as theatre, or what is accepted into the theatre club, has shifted quite dramatically.
Yeah, I think it has.
Have you found that what you care about and what you value has changed as well? Like, what... I'm curious about what the threads are that have stayed the same and what's been different.
I mean, I think lots of things have stayed the same. The plays of David Hare. More plays by David Hare produced at the National Theatre.
Still telling us what we all already know.
Yeah. But actually, I mean, I guess during that period of time, I think one of the reasons why actually I've been hugely lucky as somebody who's kind of been a commentator on theatre is because it happened to be at a time when theatre was really, really changing. And I think that is largely because it started looking out more rather than looking in. I think at the point when I started writing about theatre, again back in the 1980s, I would say that one of the things that, there was this kind of idea that British theatre was the best theatre in the world. And we had the finest actors and the best playwrights. And British theatre is absolutely fantastic. Don't get me wrong. But I think one of the reasons we felt that is quite simply because we hadn't really noticed what it was that other people were doing all around the world.
Yes.
We tended to look inwards, not outwards. So I think that was substantially changed. And I think the London International Festival of Theatre had a lot to do with that, that people suddenly went, oh, this is kind of really, you know, fascinating and different from what we think of as being theatre. I think as a result of that, people started thinking about form a great deal more. And I think the other thing that has happened is not in any way a downgrading of the primacy of the playwright, but just the absolute acceptance that that what a play is and might be is can be many, many different things. So, you know, once we made a distinction between physical work and devised work and a play, now I think that many people will see those things as all being part and parcel of the same thing.
I wouldn't know where the lines were between.
I think it's impossible, and I think that's been a really, really good thing for British theatre. And I think that it's really encouraged a kind of experimentation. And certainly one of the things is that often when I've reviewed things, you know, and it might be something that's happening in a cupboard under a stairwell, or it might have been a night spent in a treehouse in a forest in Norfolk. And people would say to me, but Lynn, is that really theatre? And my view always to that is that's the wrong question.
Who cares?
What is really interesting is what is it that theatre might be?
And also, was it... I think more and more... Because I remember being, again, when I was a kid, being shortlisted for some bursary thing for young directors, and them asking me what the most impactful thing I'd seen was that year. And it was... it was a thing at the court, the fever that Wallace Shawn.
Wallace Shawn.
And one of the panels was like, "Oh, but it's not really a play, is it?"
Yeah.
And I was like, "Well, I mean, I don't care. Actually, what I care about is was I transported? Did it add? Did I leave changed? Did it add to the sum of my knowledge of the world? Was it fun? That's all I care about."
I always think it's interesting, and because you sort of don't know about these things. I mean, when I was at university, I directed a great deal. But interestingly, I never directed on the Gulbenkian stage. Everything I did was in stairwells, or I covered the JCR with tinfoil and nightlights and put on things that. And I sort of wasn't aware of it at the time that I was kind of experimenting in quite that way. But when I think now, often of the kinds of forms and areas of theatre that I've really embraced, what I was kind of, you know, trying in my very clumsy way to do when I was a student.
I directed for some students at East 15 probably a decade ago now, and we did a sort of a theoretically immersive production of The Malcontent, as immersive as you can get in a classroom, you know. And I just bumped into one of them in the street recently, and she was like, "Did you know we pissed on some of the sheets and left them under the radiator, and then we left some prawns in just so that it smelt right?" And I was like, "I mean, I'm so glad. I would have given you an A, but and those things that kind of are happening that you don't know are happening in people's heads that sort of start shaping their practice.
I think that's so true. And, you know, one of the reasons that I really feel quite depressed about the fact that, for example, A-level studies, theatre studies, is now quite significantly, the most recent figures, on the decline, the number of students who are taking that, is because I think it's been hugely influential in terms of helping to shape theatre. Because the people who are often doing that have been taught by people who are really, really keen on alternative kind of modes of expression and forms of theatre. It's often been because they've studied companies, whether they're Frantic Assembly or Forced Entertainment, who actually have very good kind of resources, so easy to kind of do the lessons. And I think that has then an influence on the people who eventually do go on to make theatre. I mean, I'm not for a moment saying that the reason to do theatre studies is to create more theatre makers. But I think that it does have an influence, and I think that it will be very interesting to see
what happens
as time goes by, and if those numbers continue to decline. About what effect that actually then has on theatre culture.
Because I remember that, A-level theatre studies, I remember that as the first time I'd ever been allowed to make a thing myself.
Right, yeah.
First time I was ever allowed to speak my own words.
Yeah.
Or someone, you know, one of my peers' words.
Yeah.
Because before that, it'd been Shakespeare or it'd been Carol Churchill or it'd been, you know, brilliant plays, but nothing placed value on anything that came from me.
Yeah. And that's so crucial, because I think that moment when either somebody else, either through a course, or you yourself, give yourself permission to actually say, oh, I might be creative, I might be able to make something,
like, I think is a really, really important.
Hearing. Yeah, that, is a really, really important thing.
And you're right, you know, not just to be an artist, but to be a human being in the world.
Yeah. Yeah, but that actually, I think that's true about writers as well. I mean, one of the reasons that I think that about people who write about theatre, and one of the reasons that you know, lots of people, particularly if you get a few journalists gathered together, you know, theatre writers, is often the mood from some people is, you know, is very, very gloomy, and because of the number of layoffs there are and people losing their jobs. But actually, I think we need to look at it the other way, which is that there are more people now writing about theatre on a regular basis than there have been in the whole of my theatre-going life.
Yeah.
And I think the fact that there are more people writing about theatre in whatever form that that might take, and goodness, in some cases it might be as small as 280 characters on a tweet. But being able to express what they think and feel, and many of them, of course, are doing it, you know, on other platforms and writing long form about that, I think is really, really good for theatre. And I think it is all part of the critical culture.
Yeah, because it means you, it means you're invested and you care about it. And so this is interesting, because I think I've just had a new thought for myself. Because I've always been slightly, like, any kind of citizen reviewer is always welcome in any theatre that I have the right to give them a ticket to. Or, you know, any kind of non, I mean, the words professional and amateur are difficult and loaded, but anyone can come and review. I'm on board for that. Come and see the show. But I've often, in the past, been frustrated with ill-considered or ill-informed or just lazy, quick critical responses, not just of my work, but of all sorts of people's, on the Twitter or on, I can't think of an appropriate website, but actually, and it always used to sort of annoy me, but maybe I need to challenge my habitual notions of value. Because actually, when I choose to go to a restaurant when I'm travelling, and I'm an obsessive foodie, I care more about food than I do about theatre, really. Probably. don't tell anyone. I value the 200 characters on Yelp or on TripAdvisor from all of those people that have experienced this restaurant before. I value that incredibly. And yet I don't habitually apply that same process to theatre, and I should, I think.
And why don't
why
you?
Why don't I?
Why don't you?
Because I'm a snob. Because, you know, maybe if I was a professional chef, I wouldn't value those things.
Yeah.
Because I'm a because I'm a professional theatre maker, because I see more of this stuff than any sane person should. As do you, right? I am cynical, so it takes a bit more to impress me. And sometimes, you know, I'm conscious that as I've got older, I see brilliant shows, and I'm like, well, it's really just regurgitating that thing I saw in 1999, you know. And I am jaded because it's such a difficult
What is it? Because the exchange, the thing you're asking from the audience, is actually quite a lot more. You're asking the audience to give you more of their time and emotional commitment and financial commitment and intellectual energy than you are for a meal. So I don't... Yeah, I'm a dick. I mean, it's because... Like, I'm not saying it's a good choice.
Yeah.
But I'm saying I'm aware of that in myself. I think there
is a thing about kind of valuing the audience response. Kirsty Sedgman, who is a really interesting academic who writes really around the ideas of the audience.
Mm.
She recently had a piece on Exeunt where she was talking about... how we don't really value audience responses. And she said something I think is really interesting. I think it's kind of probably a deliberate paraphrase of that Rimini protocol idea that the audience are experts in their own life.
Yes.
And it says that audience are experts in their own response. What we actually end up doing is applying kind of value judgments, which are around that we don't quite, trust that response of the ordinary audience member over the professional, and that what it is to do with is around judgments about what is value, and those are often hugely tied up with what we think is great art or is not great
because
art.
Isn't that interesting? Because actually, I do really care that my audience has an amazing time. I care more that they have an amazing time than, I mean, I want you to have a good time, Lynn, but I care more that, people who haven't seen 8 shows this week have a great time, because it's more precious to them somehow. And yet my habitual notions of, like, self-worth, probably, like, it's about getting into the club, right?
Yeah.
So even though I really want the audience to have an amazing time, those audience reviews don't get me into the club.
Yeah.
Whatever it is.
But I think that theatre does these things all the time, because I think that theatre completely colludes in those ideas about what it values and what it doesn't value. And again, I don't for a moment want to be seen as being disingenuous, but, why is it that actually that they might value the view of Lynn Gardner more than they actually value the review of Lynn Smith, who actually has seen everything that they put on at their theatre in the main space and in the studio and has done for the last kind of 5 or 6 years, and may actually have her own form, be an expert in the work of that particular regional theatre.
Yes.
And
how it speaks to this particular audience.
I think that's one of the things that's problematic about being a critic, and though I've been a great I've felt that it's really important that the regional theatre is covered by the mainstream press, and really pushed when I was at The Guardian to make sure that it was. I think there is something in the same way that there is about parachuting artists into work in a particular community without them really being familiar and embedded and knowing about that community. I think there is something odd about parachuting a critic in reviewing that work, particularly if it is perhaps only one piece in an ongoing season. And it's one of the reasons why I think that if there is a crisis in criticism, in the sense that I think we can inevitably say that the trend in terms of coverage will be down, particularly in terms of coverage in the regions, then I think what it is that theatres really have to do is harness the experts in their own community, who are regularly seeing the work and therefore actually could be in a constant dialogue with it, in a way that actually somebody just coming in to see or two things in the season, probably the things which are the most high profile that may have a bit of star casting, are never going to be able to do. And by that, I don't just mean actually people who perhaps would name themselves as being bloggers. Mm. I think it needs to be a much more... a much wider thing, which needs to be seen as audience development, that needs to be seen about the fact that you develop a audience, basically, of, I guess, critical friends.
Yeah. Yes. Like, so alongside, sorry, I'm just thinking, when I'm next running a regional theatre,
yeah.
So there's something about having a critical platform that facilitates and nurtures a dialogue amongst the people that are seeing your work regularly from that theatre, that runs alongside the artistic programme. So you're almost programming the critical sphere as well as the artistic one. Not in terms of saying what must be said, but in terms of giving it the space to exist.
I think giving it the space and giving it the support in order to exist, and giving it the oxygen in order to exist. And I think that that is... not about closing the debate down around theatre, but actually opening it up. I mean, one of the things that I find endlessly fascinating, I don't follow a huge number of theatres on Twitter, because at 10 past 10, somebody from marketing arrives and suddenly they start retweeting all positive things that were said about the show last night. That's about broadcasting things. It's secondly, you know, it's only probably one part of the story, the one that reflects they feel positively on them or on the theatre. But I think the other thing about it is that it shuts down the idea that conversations around theatre must be a dialogue.
Mm.
Yeah. And a dialogue in context. And I think that... you know, that one of the things that, rather than simply kind of colluding by plastering up all the 4- and 5-star reviews outside the theatre or posting them on Twitter, actually that theatres need to think about developing a real critical culture around their audiences.
Mm. And giving you something to like to chew on. Like, I was just thinking about... I think Chris Good once said to me that, you know, the ideal, if you're going to have stars, what you want on your poster is 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 in a triangle, you know.
That would be brilliant, wouldn't it?
Wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be amazing? because then you know that there is space for you as an audience member in that piece to have a your reaction will be your own.
Yeah. And often, of course, it's the case with professional reviews, again, in mainstream press, that often, you know, they're pretty much the same, i.e. company gets 4 or 5 stars from absolutely everybody. You know, something else gets, you know, 2 stars pretty well from everybody. And, of course, one of the things that, you know, that is about is quite simply that on the whole, critics are drawn from a particular strata of university educated, middle class, theatre going, you know, people. And so, you know, I think again, the reason why actually having a wider critical dialogue with your audience is useful, because it allows theatres, or makes theatres perhaps, think about who it is they are not yet serving as much as who it is that they are.
I went as a guest with a theatre critic who I will not name to see a West End show that I will not name because it would be cruel to everyone concerned. And we both bloody hated the show. You know, it was beautifully done. It was very expensive. It was slick. It was stupid, and it added nothing, and it was sort of a waste of our time. Yeah. And we left talking about that.
Yeah.
And the critic, who I love, dear, you know, I appreciate their contribution to the sphere. was like, oh, well, you know, it'll be a 3 or a 4 star. And I was like, you hate this show. But because of the context that it was sitting in, because of the production values, because of the theatre it was in and the star casting, it couldn't be the 2 or 1 that it deserved.
Listen, I just think that's wrong.
It's really annoying, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's annoying. I think it's wrong. And I think that, to a certain degree, I think there's a form of kind of corruption around that as well. Because I don't think any theatre in any context is untouchable. Yeah,
and no one is served by that.
I don't think anyone is served by that. And I think that people actually sort of see through it to a large degree. Yeah.
I find it's one of the things that I find most heartbreaking, actually. Because I rarely, you know, I can't afford to spend 40, 50 quid on a theatre ticket with regularity. So I'm in a, you know, let's assume that I don't have anyone I can ask. I'm in the same position as all of the other people that take a punt on a show twice a year. And it's heartbreaking because that 40 quid, that's a weekend out with, well, I don't have kids, but it's a weekend out with my kids. It's, if it's 60 quid, it's a Eurostar ticket to Paris.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the comparable experiences that, and I hate measuring things in terms of money, but that's all that we have, apparently.
Yeah. But one of the things, you see, I often feel about us critics, we are too kind. I don't mean necessarily in the way that we write, but I think in the starring of it. There are very few 1 or 2 star reviews.
And I see mostly 2 star shows.
Yeah, they're mostly, you know, 3 star reviews. And I think a 3 star review, you're saying, well, this is really quite good. You know,
it's above the middle.
Yeah, and I think that it is kind of problematic because, as you say, we all know that an awful lot of theatre is actually just so-so.
Mm.
It's not particular. It's not terrible, but it's not great either.
Yeah. So I'm going to move on because I'm conscious that you have to go and do things in a minute.
Yes, I do actually.
Yes. I just want to. Yeah. So I'm so sad that you're no longer blogging for The Guardian. I think that's. I mean, that was stupid of them. And it, your blog was so valuable to, I think, my whole generation as kind of emerging theatre makers. It really shaped how I thought, and it was this kind of brilliant window into a theatre world that I wasn't part of. What are you doing now?
Well, I'm still blogging. I'm blogging at the stage quite regularly. I've just started working for Digital Theatre Plus, which is a primarily educational website, which has some absolutely kind of fabulous content of academics talking about some of the great theatre makers of our day, as well as having full filmed versions of those productions, which Amazing. Is great. I'm reviewing for a startup called Stage Door. It's an app.
And this is what you're going to launch tomorrow, right? We're recording this the day before the big launch, guys. Yeah. This is an exclusive.
Yeah, so that's going to be my new home for reviewing theatre. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to be going about it in a slightly different way. So there won't be any star ratings.
Mm-hmm.
This might be horrible for people because actually they may actually have to read the words to find out what I think about something. But the other thing that I'm going to do is I'm going to write about theatre and not be tied to what is opening that week.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it sort of comes in some ways from the fact that it often feels to me that some of the best theatre writing that there is around at the moment isn't the kind of knee-jerk reaction of having seen something
and the night before
or, you know, seen something and having to rush off and file that piece of copy. Because we all know that you need time to actually sort of process a piece of theatre. You often have to let it sit with you. And one of the things I love most is that moment when you come to write about something and you discover that actually you didn't think exactly what you thought about it immediately afterwards. And actually that moment when you turn to a friend and afterwards and say, oh, wasn't that rubbish or wasn't that great? And then you sit and think about it. I had a really good example of that actually in Edinburgh this year, where I sat watching Katie Mitchell's La Maladie d'Amour, and pretty well not hating it the whole way through. But then in the process of the 25-minute walk across the meadows to the other side of town, you know, on my own, starting to kind of think about it and reflect upon it and suddenly go, oh, that bit there, that was so interesting. And what perspective was that story being told from? And as it was, I then had to write about it kind of then the next morning. But I would be interested about what happens, in fact, sometimes if you leave something for a few days, possibly even a few weeks, and how you start trying to see how that piece of theatre might sit in a context and how it might bounce off other pieces of theatre that you see. So I would say that what I'm doing for Stage Door is going to be very much a work in progress. I think it will take you know, a few weeks or a few months even to see how this develops, how it may work. But it does feel to me as though it's a kind of, you know, quite an exciting new chapter in what I'm doing.
It feels like you're talking about being interested in process as much as product. So it feels like your practice is becoming more process-based. Yeah,
well, maybe it is, but because, of course, actually, I've really, you know, for the last, well, in fact, always really in my critical life, really have written for publications that have absolutely demanded that I produce a product that...
for a deadline.
Effectively comments on another product. And I think that this, over time, may well have the opportunity to develop into...
More reciprocity. More
I think that's true. And often, you know, one of the things that I've often found kind of quite interesting in the past is sometimes, and it often happened on the blog, when I would have an opportunity to see something which had been reviewed elsewhere in the paper by Michael Billington when I was at The Guardian. But then I, a couple of weeks later, would write about it, but write about it in an entirely different context. Yes. So an example of that would be Annie Baker's Flick, which I remember seeing at the National probably, you know, a couple of weeks after the reviews had appeared. And I wrote about it in the context of liveness and what it means as theatre to be live and what it means to be theatre in a digital culture.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, and that's an entirely different kind of criticism than
and
writing.
The show means something different coming at it with that eye.
Of course it does. Of course it does. Yeah. So, you know, you know, so I'm not saying, I'm not for a moment suggesting that what I'm going to do is in any way kind of radical or startlingly different from what might be done elsewhere, but I think is probably a different way of writing than we are mostly used to.
And also just that incremental shift in focus, especially from someone who is such a figure of the mainstream theatre critical world, like that feels actually quite important, because generally, you know, the big boys don't, or the big girls don't write like that. because they're in a more traditional structure.
Well, the great thing about this is that I am no longer in that structure, and you know, and the fact that this is a digital platform is actually really important to me, because I really genuinely think that that's the future. What I would say, and has been a source of kind of heartache and me kind of thinking about whether, you know, when I sort of got on board with this, is that at the moment it is only London-based, which is for very good reasons for a very young start-up. But it's got ambitions to become a to become UK-wide, and that would certainly be something that I would encourage and would look forward to. And I do think it's also possible that I may start to review out of London, perhaps for the stage in the future. So, okay.
So I'm just going to say it again so that people can download it. That's the Stage Door app.
Yeah, it's called Stage Door app. It's completely free to download.
Okay, brilliant.
So do take a look.
And then the other project you were talking about was Digital
Theatre Plus.
Digital Theatre Plus. And can normal people subscribe to that?
Yeah, well, they can, in fact, as an individual. It is mostly universities and schools who currently do so. I think there are individual subscriptions, and I think it's something that they are very much looking to develop.
Okay. And if you're obsessive, then why not? Yeah. So very last question. Because I think it's interesting talking to you about legacy and other things, because your medium isn't as ephemeral as everyone else I have spoken to thus far.
But it's still yesterday, tomorrow's fish and chips.
Yeah. But somewhere in a newspaper, you know, somewhere in a library, if those still exist, there may be a microfiche if those still exist. There's something tangible that one can hold afterwards, I guess. So I'm just kind of curious when. So one of the questions I ask everyone is, when you leave this place, and artistic directors have the opportunity to take that as this building or like this you know, astral plane. What would you like to leave behind that wasn't here when you arrived? If in 50 years. Someone says, oh, did you that podcast with Lynn Gardner? And I'd say, yes, she was brilliant. She did this.
Oh, I think I'd hope that people would say she tried to hold the door open.
That's really nice. Good. Okay. Thank you, Lynn.